Good morning. This is Keep 106.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good things are coming your way.
Hello and welcome to Ridgeway Magazine with me, John Shepherd, and Andy Venton. Oh, heaps of stuff in the programme today. We take a look at scams, very old and new, with the help of local journalist Roger Guthridge. Old wives' tales like Cast Not a Clout Before May Is Out are always with us, in one form or another, but is there any truth to them? And what is meant by me time? The answer is contained in our report on solo women travellers.
And reports indicate that landlords are ignoring the new tenant tax and other regulations that might result in lower profits for property owners and higher rents for tenants. It's a complicated subject, and we do our best to encourage landlords to comply with new hard-hitting regulations. As part of Dorset Police's No Excuses campaign, they have impounded 2,400 vehicles. We explain what happens when your vehicle is seized. It might be the last time you see it. And finally, the latest on the saga of Weymouth's seaside lighting plan. Will it ever happen?
Keep 106.
Local journalist Roger Guthridge joins us live in the studio today to tell us about a very unusual scam which dates back several hundred years. It happened in Dorset and nobody came out of it very well. So, Roger, over to you.
I think one person might have come out of it all right, actually. But this dates back just over 300 years and the action takes place at Winford Eagle, which, for those who don't know the geography, is about 7 or 8 miles northwest of Dorchester, fairly near Maiden Newton, I think. And the lords of the manor were the Sydenham family, and everything went fine until the early 1700s, when the last in the male line, one William Sydenham, ran into financial difficulties. And he thought up a rather smart plan to solve his financial problems. And what he thought he'd do was organise a private lottery, sell tickets, and then offer the Winford Eagle estate, the entire manor and estate, as the prize. That was the public plan, but there was also a private plan, because his other idea, which was up his sleeve, was to arrange the outcome in advance with an acquaintance who would then restore the estate to him in exchange for a cash reward. So this happened, the lottery tickets, loads of tickets were sold, and a suitable person had been chosen, a woman described as a confidant of the family. But unfortunately for him, she had other ideas. She was duly declared the winner of the prize and then insisted that she was going to claim the full estate, and threatened William Sydenham that if he didn't hand over the deeds, make over the entire property to her, she would welsh on him and get him into trouble by exposing the whole thing. Well, Mr. Sydenham obviously was a bit of a problem for him. In the meantime, this lady actually, with her newfound wealth, found herself a husband. He then promptly sold the estate to a third party, which complicated the whole thing. Meantime, Sydenham and his two daughters flatly refused to move, pretty well chaining themselves to the building. Eventually they were evicted, and he spent the last 9 years of his life languishing in Dorchester jail, and in fact died in 1718.
So what happened to the woman? Because, of course, women weren't allowed to own property in those days, were they?
No, they weren't, which is why she found herself a husband, pretty smartish. But he was called Doyley Mitchell or Michelle. He then sold the estate, which obviously they had the money from the sale of the estate, so it removed the problem from them altogether. So nothing is recorded about what happened to them, but one can only assume they used their wealth and lived out their days as very wealthy people.
Good heavens. Well, that's quite a story. And, of course, that sort of scam is still going on today, isn't it? We do hear about people putting up property for sale and engineering a lottery and then nothing happens as a result of. I think it happened locally in Bournemouth. Have a feeling.
Well, last year or within the last year or two, this wasn't a scam, I have to say, but a couple in Ringwood area, just within the Dorset boundary, I think, did actually offer their luxury house as a lottery prize, but they didn't sell enough tickets to cover it, so at the end of the day, they withdrew the offer.
Did they give the money back, do you know?
I think they were planning to give the money back, yeah.
Yes,
I don't think they had any choice there.
Yes, exactly. Now then, the long arm of the law would obviously have had a great interest in what they were doing. Now then, you've been a journalist for nearly 50 years. And
Don't remind me.
Well, I beat you by a few years, but never mind, never mind. Tell me, you were a swimming correspondent? I never come across a swimming correspondent before.
Yes, it's something I dived into almost by chance.
Oh, hum.
Yeah, sorry.
A good journalistic pun. You have good puns to be a journalist.
Yeah, well, that wasn't a very good one, was it? But
it's good enough as Keep 106, I can promise you.
I'm a reasonable swimmer. Even to this day, I swim for Dorset and Poole. In master swimming, which is sort of competitive swimming for geriatrics, as I always say, or older age groups. I'm in the 65 and over age group now. And through that, about 35 years ago, I was asked to write... I was working for the Bournemouth Daily Echo, and I was asked to write their swimming roundup for 2 weeks in the absence of someone else. But the local clubs liked it so much because I was a journalist and the other guy was just a coach. And A, I was unbiased, and B, I knew how to present the stuff. And the clubs wrote in and asked if I could write it every week. I continued to do that for 30 years up until last November. And in the meantime, I became press officer for the Great Britain swimming team in 1999 for 2 or 3 years, and had the luxury of travelling around the world with the British team and being paid for it to World and European Championships and so on. And through that, I then became deputy editor of Swimming Times magazine, which was the oldest swimming magazine in the world until it sadly went out of print earlier this year after 96 years, having just failed to make its centenary.
I must tell you that when I was working on an evening newspaper, the sports reporters were all taken ill with flu, and I know nothing about football whatsoever, don't even like it particularly. And I was sent off to do a report on a match, miles and miles away, travelled in the team coach. The idea was at half-time, you got on the telephone and gave the half-time report. Being an evening paper, they would publish it. So I did. I gave the half-time report, and I got back to the dugout. It was perishing cold, I remember. And then I had to write a report for Monday's paper, which I did. I got the score wrong. Because what happened was, when I went to telephone my copy in at half-time, the match had restarted. There'd been a goal scored, and none of the other reporters, who didn't like this interloper from an evening newspaper, told me. So that was my inglorious sports reporting. Never asked to do a football match again.
No, I'm sure
you
weren't.
Let me talk to you about 50 years. I mean, you must have had some incredible experiences, all journalists too. Can you give me a remarkable one?
I could give you quite a few remarkable ones, actually.
Oh, come back and see us again.
I will. I think my favourite story, because of the way it unfolded, there was a double murder in Bournemouth in the mid-80s, and I was chief reporter for the Bournemouth Echo at the time. And what we used to do in those days, I think they still do, is when something of that magnitude had occurred, obviously you can't print much until the trial is over. So what you do is you build up background stuff, material, and then as soon as the trial is over, you can publish it. And I managed to, by building a kind of relationship with the mother of the man accused of two murders and an attempted murder, I was trying to get information from her, and she kept saying, I used to call in on her on my way home from work about once a week and have a cup of tea and say, oh, can you tell me about your son? She kept saying, I'll only tell you if he actually agrees. So I said, well, ask him. And she came back to me and said, well, he says if you'd like to write him a letter, he'll answer it. So I did that with my questions. I then called in to see her again, and she said, unfortunately, the prison governor at Winchester Jail refused to let him reply. So I was disappointed, but she said, well, there is another option. And I said, what's that? She said, well, I don't drive, but I'd like to visit my son at Winchester from time to time on remand. So if you can drive me up there, you can come with me. So I went to Winchester Prison before the trial, took his mother, removed all press ID, didn't have a reporter's notebook or recorder, obviously, because that would have been a giveaway. But we spent an hour and a half, his mother and I, talking to him. And the arrangement was that we would memorise everything he said. And then we stopped at the first service station at Randlands on the M27, and I wrote everything down. And it came out as a huge story in the Bournemouth Echo, 3 pages. My message to the people of Bournemouth by Double Killer, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, wonderful stuff. Lovely headlines.
Yes, and it outscooped all, because all the national tabloids were all over this story, but nobody had anything like that. I had an interview with him in prison. I had extracts from his diary. I had pictures of his artwork, which was a bit gruesome. So it was all quite a good, strong story, really, and I was very pleased with that.
I bet you were. Do you have another one?
Another story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we'll let you go.
Yeah, OK. I think going back a little further to the 1970s, and I and a friend were having a pint at a pub in Ferndown, and we had to go home in opposite directions. So after closing time at 11-something... we were standing outside having a chat, and there were two groups of youths, or sorry, there was a large group of youths with two cars, and in the car park at the pub. And what they did, they caught our attention because they couldn't get one started. So what they did, they drove the other car into the back of it and pushed it along to bump start it. So they pushed one car along with the other, which seemed like an interesting way to start a car.
Exactly.
The following morning, as every morning, I picked up the phone and phoned the local police station to find out what had happened overnight. And they said, oh, there was a car stolen. This was outside, and it belonged to the landlord of another pub at Wimborne, actually 4 or 5 miles away. And I just took a note of that. And then the officers said, it was a bit strange, though, because there's something wrong with the ignition and the car couldn't be started except by bump starting. And I said, describe the car to me. And he did, and it answered the description of the one we'd seen in the car park at the other pub. So I phoned my friend, checked on his memory of it, phoned the police back, and as a result of that, it helped the police to crack a gang of car thieves who had been nicking cars all over Dorset and further west as well. So I was very, very popular, genuinely popular with the police. Now, the guy in charge of that case was a detective sergeant who went on to become head of Dorset CID in later years, and I can't tell you how many really big stories I got from him because of that one incident where he trusted me, he knew I was on the ball, and whenever there was a big inside background story or something like that, he would phone me up and said, oh, here's one, Roger, you might want to know about. And thank you very much.
Well, being a good reporter is all about having good contacts. And we've made a good contact today. So, Roger, thank you very much indeed for coming in to see us. And I'm going to invite you back, because I'm sure you've got lots more to tell us.
Ridgeway Magazine, on Wednesdays at 11, tackles local issues with local views from local people, with John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
Now then, to bring you completely up to date on the latest strict aimed at elderly people particularly, Dorset Police has issued this warning. It goes like this. The victim receives an email purporting to come from TV licensing. It looks authentic, like all scams do, and it asks for personal, financial and bank details. Sometime later, the victim receives a telephone call from an employee pretending to be from the bank's security staff, suggesting the victim's account has been fraudulently compromised. Then follows the trick. The victim is persuaded to move the contents of their bank account to another safe, in inverted commas, bank account suggested by the bogus bank security staffer. This is naturally the fraudster's own account, and in the twinkling, or realistically, the stroke of a computer keyboard, the money disappears. Fraudsters are masters at stealing personal details that makes them sound so convincing. And when they home in for the kill, they very often succeed. Now, the police, Dorset Police, for the umpteenth time, warn folk never ever to reveal personal financial details and PIN numbers over the telephone, and banks will never ever ask you for them over the phone anyway. And the advice is never to click onto sites which ask for personal details. And remember, a favourite scam these days is perpetrated or purported to come from HMRC, telling people they're either going to be prosecuted because they haven't paid tax or they've got a tax rebate. The HMRC, the taxman, will never, ever telephone you. All their correspondence is done by mail. So please don't fall for the trick.
From Dorchester, this is Keep 106.
Now we're going to have a bit of fun with this. Now, I don't know what your granny used to tell you, but my granny was full of wisdom. The dreadful weather at the end of April reminded her, or reminded me, of one of her favourite sayings. Cast not a clout till May is out, she'd say. And as a little lad, it took me ages to work out what it meant. But in her view, you shouldn't put away your winter clothes, clout, of course, is the old English word for clothing, until the weather improves at the end of May. Now, if proof of this, if proof was ever needed, in my garden over Easter, the temperature hovered between the high 70s and low 80s. And yesterday, it was 60, and today, it's about 50. Now, we refer to old wives' tales without really thinking about their truthfulness or practicality, but many have actually stood the test of time, from rubbing a lemon on warts so they fall off, well, actually they don't, to an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, we know that that is quite true, particularly if you eat four more bits of fruit or vegetable as well. So eating up your greens isn't all an old wives' tale. So, Andy, let's examine some more.
OK, well, old wives' tales are not necessarily about the practicalities in life. They're also wrapped in superstition, but they do serve to make the people who believe in them happier and secure. Some are used to ward off evil spirits, and others are employed to generate good luck. We won't go into Friday the 13th. Unlucky for millions for no fathomable reason other than superstition surrounding the number 13. But there are those with a grain of truth, so here goes. John and I, being follically challenged, don't have much of a problem with this one about grey hairs. It's said that if you pull one out, two more will grow in its place. However much we who are thin on top might like the idea, it has no truth, having been researched by cosmetic scientists. Now, we used to be told as youngsters that sitting too close to the television set in the darkened front room would damage your eyesight. Yes, going back to the birth of TV in the 1950s and 60s, there was a spot of truth in that. It started in the United States, where colour TV was far in advance of the UK, where colour didn't appear on our screens until the 1970s. In the States, early colour receivers emitted 100,000 times more radiation than health officials in the United States considered safe. Sets made by one manufacturer were even recalled. Although there was no colour TV in the UK at the time, the myth grew that too much television was bad for your eyes, and I can remember people having this opinion. There was no truth in it, because by the time we got colour from the BBC, radiation levels were insignificant.
Now then, while still on the subject of eyesight, will reading in a dimly lit room harm your eyes? And the answer is no, but it might make them tired, so stop doing it. And here's a lovely old wives' tale about carrots. Are they going to help you see in the dark? And does eating them regularly help your eyesight in general? In World War II, fighter pilot John Cunningham was the first to shoot down a German plane at night using a top-secret gun sight. He could see German planes in the dark. But in order to keep this very important gunnery development secret from the enemy, he said that his ability was helped by eating carrots that made him see in the dark. British officials and the RAF kept up the story to fool the Germans, and so the myth was born. Now, how often have you heard that if you spill red wine on a carpet, the best thing to do is to use white wine to clean it up? Well, slightly true, but mainly false. You see, there are two different kinds of alcohol. It's true that rubbing alcohol will help to remove the stain, but drinking alcohol used as a stain remover will only make the problem worse. You'll end up with a sticky carpet with a sugary stain forever. Now, does eating chocolates cause acne? Again, yes and no. The raw ingredients of chocolate, that's the cocoa bean itself, has no effect on the skin. However, milk and sugar in the chocolate bar might cause pimples if eaten to excess, and just looking at a box of chocs might make some people break out in a rash. So while eating cocoa beans, chocolate has no adverse effect. It is all the milk and sugar. And I think it's a very helpful warning for next Easter, don't you, Andy?
Now, salt features in old wives' tales. Spilling salt was supposed to bring bad luck because in the 15th century, when people examined the famous painting of the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci, Judas Iscariot appears to have knocked over a pile of salt. This gave rise to the belief that spilling salt was the harbinger of bad luck and misfortune brought upon you by the devil, who waits for an opportunity to do you harm. However, our resourceful old wives said that if you picked up the spilled salt and threw it over your left shoulder, you would blind the devil who lurked behind you, waiting to make trouble. Now, who believes terrible things happen in threes? I bet there's a lot of belief in this old wives' tale. It's pure superstition and has no validity except for what's in our minds. Now, here's an ancient tale about pennies. The rhyme goes like this. Find a penny, pick it up, and all the day you will have good luck. Or as I'd like to say, find a penny and pick it up, and all the day you'll have a penny. But I digress. It dates back thousands of years when coins were first minted. In ancient times, it was believed metal, like copper, was a gift from the gods. It therefore followed there was a special relationship between coins that were found and good luck.
Now then, here's one you often hear repeated. Feed a cold, starve a fever. Rubbish! The word starve is mispronounced. In Old English, it was stave, meaning to prevent or stave off. Basically, keep eating, if only a little chicken soup, to feed the fever and the cold. Starving makes you weak, and is not a good thing if you're unwell. Now, a habit that makes me feel quite ill, hearing and seeing people crack their knuckles. Old wives say it will give you arthritis. Not true, but the habit might get the perpetrators some nasty looks if they do it in public. And finally, does the hair of a dog work? Now, Andy, you're an expert. That is, feeling a hangover with more alcohol. It doesn't work after the initial jolt.
No, it doesn't.
Hey, but the phrase comes from the belief that if you're bitten by a dog, you must pluck a hair from its coat, and by doing so, you will recover from the bite. Nonsense, but the phrase survives.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106 with John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
Still to come in this edition of Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106, we hear about a development in the travel industry in which tens of thousands of women are choosing to travel to holiday destinations alone. We hear about new laws for landlords and what happens when police seize a vehicle and take it off the road. Finally, more on the saga of the Weymouth Esplanade lighting scheme. Will they ever shine out?
So, stay tuned as we hear a lot about women and travel these days. It's called Me Too Times, when people just want to be alone some of the time. Now, Ridgway Magazine has reported in the past on man sheds, meaning a place in the home or garden which is a men-only space where a chap can indulge his interests and hobbies away from the rest of the family. But what I hadn't realised was that Me Time is not just for men, it's for women too, and is manifesting itself in an ever-increasing way. Women's holidays habits are changing. The industry reports more female travellers are choosing to travel solo, or maybe with a female companion. And so to check this out, I popped in to see Nigel Alexander, manager of Dorchester Travel, and this is what he told me. From what I hear, there's a new sector in the travel industry, or the holiday industry, called Me Time. What is that, Me Time?
Well, exactly as it says, really. It's about having time for yourself. And I think people are so fed up with being constrained to doing what their other half needs to do all the time. I think they've decided that because a lot of people have got financial independence these days, they can branch out and do their own thing.
So this is women coming to you saying, I want to travel on my own?
And with friends. It's predominantly ladies, you're correct. Men don't seem to be quite so adventurous, I find. Ladies do tend to be more adventurous than men. And ladies either come on their own with family members or perhaps with friends. And they come together, perhaps as twos, perhaps as fours, perhaps on their own. And they decide they want an adventure. They're fed up just being at home.
And I suppose women these days have their own money.
Very much so. They either earn their own money or they have their own money by other sources. And, you know, some couples have their own money completely separately. Some just have their, you know, just divide their money up. It's however they suit their own circumstances. But very, very many couples have financial independence and women have their own money. Why not?
I think women, you often hear, well, we hear it being said, women want to spend their own money in their own way. So this is percolating down to the travel industry. You said that women are more adventurous.
Oh, without any shadow of doubt. Left to the men, I don't think many people would travel these days. We find that many, many couples leave the decisions on holidays down to the ladies. It's the ladies who, I think, make most of those decisions.
And we're not just talking about the Prosecco-fueled jaunts to Spain. We're talking about more serious travel. Where are women going to?
Well, on the whole, their destinations in Europe. There's quite a lot of cultural things happening. People tend to like Italy. They like France. They like Austria. There's also all sorts of things. They like cruising, of course. River cruises have been very popular this year.
I'm actually told that Turkey is coming back into fashion, possibly because of the euro.
That's certainly the case to a certain extent, but we're not finding so many people from this part of the world dipping their toe in that part of Europe at the moment. But certainly, I say Italy is probably our favourite at the moment for ladies travelling by themselves.
Now, when ladies come in and talk to you about places that they might like to go and see or visit, what sort of guidance do they need from you?
Well, really, it's a case of time that they have available, i.e. to meet their diary. Duration, of course, how long they've got available. And where they want to travel from. I think those are the most important things, because very often ladies don't want to trek all the way up to London. So very often it's where they can go that's convenient for them. So what they can do from Bournemouth, Bristol, Exeter, Southampton. Those are the most important things from their point of view.
And this Me Time that we've been talking about, what is it that women do when they go on a holiday on their own?
Well, very often they like to join a small group tour. There are quite a few people these days that offer tours specifically geared at solo travellers, we'll call them, people not travelling with their other halves or people who are by themselves, or river cruise, an ocean cruise. That's predominantly the market they're aiming for.
And I understand from travel figures that 47,000 women agreed that they are solo travellers. Have you noticed an increase in Dorchester Travel?
Oh, without any shadow of doubt. In fact, only this very morning, I personally have dealt with two of them. One of them has a partner at home who just doesn't particularly like travelling. Another one is independent at the moment. So, that's just one part of a morning in one small agency in Dorset.
So this figure of 47,000 could actually be on the conservative side. When women travel abroad, do they have any concerns? I mean, do you have any advice?
Well, on the concerns, I think the most important thing, which is why I think they like to join these sort of semi-escorted departures, is they don't like the dining aspect. They like to dine, particularly in the evenings, with other people. I think it's quite daunting to walk into a restaurant and alone, especially in the evening, especially if you're a lady.
So, in other words, there could be predatory people out there sort of trying to spot a lady on her own, especially at night. I suppose lunchtime's okay, is it?
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's a predatory thing. I just think it's that unease of walking into a restaurant and feeling that you might possibly stand out. Not that I think you would, but I think it's that feeling of standing out. Lunchtime is easy because lots of people could argue that many people dine out at lunchtime anyway, but I think in the evening there's that safety in numbers aspect, that feeling that it's nice to have company over dinner in the evening. It's a nice way to spend an evening.
So in other words, women, are they better than men at finding, shall we say, friends on holiday?
Oh, very much so. I think ladies are happier to open up and be more sociable. I think men tend to be a bit more reserved, a bit more conservative on the whole.
And can you see this this trait? Is it going to gather momentum, do you suppose?
Oh, without a doubt. I think as time progresses, as more people discover these holidays exist, more people will sign up to them.
Now, let's talk about the travel business as a whole. I mean, how is overseas travel or holiday travel this year? How's it shaping up?
Well, I'd be lying to say it was going to be an amazing year. It's a little bit down on last year, but I think we've got all the Brexit concerns. That's put a damper on it a little bit. It's not going to be a record-breaking year, but people are still travelling. What we are finding, there's been a growth in the more exotic. People are certainly not holding back on places like Costa Rica, Canada, big ticket purchases, but they're holding back a little bit on their short haul.
So the doubt over the euro, or rather the lack of value in the euro, is having an effect, is it?
Well, no, it's really the Brexit that's holding people back. People have been worried about what's happening, about changing in passports, whether there are going to be any visas and all that sort of thing. Luckily, of course, there's been a hold back on that until the end of the summer period. So hopefully bookings will start to normalise for the next few months. But up until the end of March, when we were expecting to be out of the EU, things were looking a little bit tricky.
So you're keeping fingers crossed that there will be a resolution to the Brexit or the euro problem?
Well, yes. As soon as we know what's happening with Brexit, things can move properly forward on that. But at the moment, people are still booking, but there are still few people who are holding off.
Nigel Alexander, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Now, there is another side to travelling alone as a woman. Years ago, it might have been seen as brave, risky, eccentric even, but these days the travel industry reports that solo female travellers outnumber solo males by almost 2 to 1. Approaching 50,000 British women of all ages will set off, armed with, we hope, an app that will help them find a way round their chosen destination, and a Google app that will enable them to translate conversations and information in dozens of languages. The canny traveller will have tried to master some basic words and phrases before travelling, something women are better at than men. Lurid headlines in our newspapers from time to time report in graphic detail of the death of a lonely backpacker, and we might fleetingly think, what was she thinking going there on her own? But it does a disservice to the concept of getting away from it all for a complete break from routine and precious time to be alone. There's no getting away from the fact that the solo woman traveller must be aware of her own safety and vulnerability. So let's devise some golden rules for the adventurous female, given that passports, sufficient money and sensible clothing have been thought through. Given that our traveller will have checked out destinations and ruled out high-risk areas, the next most important rule is to appoint someone back home as your travel guardian. Someone has to know where you're going, where you're staying, and with whom, if that is the case, and your itinerary with dates. Arrange times to call in to report progress, because if you go missing, who's to know?
Well, you see, at home we walk around in comparative safety, but abroad, losing a wallet might prove to be disastrous. And as for losing your passport, well, the complications are too difficult to mention. Good advice is to separate credit cards so that they are not all kept in the same place. If you have more than one, and most people do, keep one in your wallet or purse and hide the other about your person. Now, in the matter of personal safety, I repeat, women are vulnerable in certain circumstances, but be aware if you are being followed late at night. And certainly be careful not to have too many drinks, especially with people you're not sure of. A very good piece of advice is to travel with a plastic door stopper to place under your hotel room door, and it'll stop all but the most insistent intruder. And use the Do Not Disturb sign and put it on the door even if you are out of the room. And when arriving at a small tourist hotel or hostel in a strange country, don't leave bags at the front desk. It invites theft or unwanted inspection when your back is turned. Take them to your room yourself and keep them there. And be very careful who you invite into your room. Best way is to keep the room to yourself. You don't need to treat your destination as a crime-infested area, but do be aware that there are always pickpockets, thieves and chances around, and to be especially careful in accepting lifts or rides in taxi. It's all common sense, really, so bon voyage.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Our part of Dorset attracts holidaymakers by the tens, maybe hundreds of thousands, and a considerable proportion of them will be looking for somewhere to stay. Leaving aside the attractions of running a B&B or a small hotel, many people will have invested in buy-to-let properties. These landlords should be aware of a raft of new laws, and these are important as many landlords and letting agents are in ignorance of them. It's called the Tenant Tax, or more formally, Section 24 of the Finance Act. On June the 1st, new rules come into force on how letting agents can charge fees to tenants. If the letting business is to be believed, landlords are burying their heads in the sand about the Act's implications. Many of the new rules are good news for tenants, and we can only give a snapshot of the implications because there's a great many changes to come which, one way or another, will affect everyone in the housing rental business. Here's some good news for renters. Deposits will be capped at 5 weeks' rent, and fees can only be charged for contract changes or termination when requested by the tenant. The cost of utilities, rates and communications services will still be charged to the tenant. If tenants are at fault, they will have to pay for such things as lost keys and damage. In future, landlords and agents cannot charge for taking up tenant references, often about £300, or charge for taking inventories, which is a nice little earner, at £100 or so.
And that's not all. Many landlords will be hit in the pocket. Mortgage tax relief on rental properties is being reduced by half, meaning landlords can only claim 25% next year as opposed to 50% this year. Any large house or flat with accommodation for five or more people now requires a house in multiple occupancy, that's HMO, licence, which costs as much as £600 in some areas. There are heavy fines for ignoring this, so best check with your local council on the requirements, which include such things as minimum size for bedrooms, and depending on the room size, how many people can share. Since April last year, newly rented homes and those with renewed tenancies will have to meet an energy performance certificate rating of E or above. It's geared to making properties more energy efficient, and this could cost landlords several £1,000 to comply. Now, new rules are planned covering eviction and unfair leasehold practices involving the banning of new houses being sold on leases. There is also the possibility of a cap on service charges, permission fees and ground rents. Much is changing, and Ridgeway Magazine was grateful to Which Magazine for having provided the information on this subject. And James Davis, a portfolio landlord and property expert offering advice to landlords, maintains rents will go up. The average landlord, he says, is going to be expecting to pay an extra £2,000 a year in tax if he has a mortgage. And by 2021, landlords with a mortgage will not be able to claim any mortgage interest as tax deductible. And this will have an effect on their own profitability.
Keep 106.
Well, we've had an inquiry from a listener who asks about police seizing vehicles and selling them. Are the police making a packet out of this? And how many police officers will be paid for by selling impounded vehicles? Not so fast. Rather a lot of assumptions there. So we asked John to turn detective and find out the truth of the matter. Here is his verdict on the subject, helped by the RAC Press Office and Dorset Police.
Well, let's deal with the legal bit first. Under the Road Traffic Act Section 165, the police can seize any vehicle being driven on the public highway which is not properly insured by the person driving it. And under the same regulation, the police could also seize a vehicle being driven by someone without a licence. And of course, vehicles involved in collisions could also be taken away. Now, so far, the penalties for no insurance and no licence are fixed at £300 plus 6 points on your licence. But it gets worse. Once stopped, the police will impound the vehicle. That means it will be seized and cannot be driven on the road until the driver or owner complies with the law and gets himself a licence. Now, just in case you think the chances of this happening are slim, Dorset Police tell me that in 2017 and 2018, 1,524 vehicles were seized on the county's roads for these sort of offences. In total, Dorset Police impounded 2,416 vehicles. They can also be impounded if improperly, illegally, or carelessly parked, being driven dangerously or inconsiderately. So, if your car has been nicked, what happens next, Andy?
Well, the vehicle, we'll call it a car because it's simpler and the vast majority that are seized are cars, is taken to a police pound. Owners then have a choice. They can go to the pound with all the relevant documentation and get the vehicle released for a fee of typically £200. And if they leave it there, an additional fee of £20 per day is payable. But if the vehicle has been seized for no tax and insurance, the owner will have to show these requirements have been met, and that might take a few days at £20 a day. Temporary insurance or a cover note for less than 30 days will not be accepted. The RAC, which was helpful in compiling this report, says that if a driver is stopped and a prosecution or penalty charge is levied for whatever reason as a result, any future insurer will need to be informed of this. Any driving offence will count against the driver when a new policy is taken out. And the rigmarole does not stop there. You will have to take with you to the police car pound proof of identity, like a passport, a valid driving licence, EU national identity, or immigration document if applicable. And all this has to be done within 7 days. If the vehicle has been impounded because it's been damaged in a collision or is in such a state that it can't be driven, or it hasn't got a current MOT, the owner will have to get a registered vehicle recovery company to take it away at the owner's cost.
Now, here's the really bad news. If you haven't been to the car pound to retrieve your vehicle within 7 days, after 14 days have passed and you've made no contact, you've lost the vehicle forever. The police can dispose of the vehicle, and they do this by sending it for auction. There's an auctioneer in Poole that specialises in selling vehicles on behalf of the police. And the agony isn't over yet, because at the auction, the prized Porsche or the family runabout might go for a song, as vehicles often do at auction when cars are offered for sale in the condition that they were recovered in. In other words, as seen, without any of the usual guarantees affecting sales. Now, when the car has been sold, the money less the auctioneer's fee and any VAT payable is given to the police, who then deduct their costs of storage at £20 a day, plus the cost of recovery, which was £200 or so, before giving the balance to the owner. And of the 2,416 vehicles impounded in Dorset in the last 2 years, how many owners did not reclaim them? We will try and find out the answer.
We will indeed. And you're listening to Ridgeway Magazine here on Keep 106. And now for the continuing saga of the Weymouth Esplanade lights. The story so far. A year ago, the artistic solution to Weymouth's seafront was unveiled and the public was allowed to have its say during a consultation period. Since then, we've been waiting to see the light. First, the lights on poles pointing out to sea were going to be ready for Easter. Then it was said they would be ready for the summer tourist influx. Until recently, Ridgeway Magazine's inquiries showed no lighting contractors had tendered for the job, and we wondered why. This went on for several months, during which time the underwhelming laser display, installed during the Olympic year in 2012, has been switched off. So, where are the new lights? Will Weymouth ever see them? Time is running out, and the funding, valued at £200,000 through the Dorset Coastal Forum, has to be spent by December, or the funding will lapse. To find out more, John spoke to Project Coordinator Natalie Poulter.
Natalie Poulter, please put me in the picture because I've been talking about Weymouth Esplanade lighting, it seems, for at least a year or two now. Where are we? Because the last I heard was that you were still looking for companies to tender for the work. And I think the job is worth about £200,000, is that right?
Well, £200,000 is the total project cost. That is obviously broken down into a number of different areas of work. So it's not necessarily a £200,000 contract that we're looking to let. In terms of where we are right now, we're in the process of procurement. So we have a tender process which is ongoing, which will yield a contractor who is able to, or a contractor or a series of contractors who are able to manufacture, procure and install the fittings on the lighting scheme, on the columns to bring the lighting scheme to fruition.
So is the tender process complete now?
The tender process is currently ongoing, that's all I can say about it.
Oh, I see. So you haven't actually got everybody's tender in at the moment. You're still working on it.
The contract has been let, that's all I can say.
Very good. Now then, can we talk about the cut-off point? Because I understand that the money which has been apportioned to this project isn't there forever, isn't ongoing forever. There is a cut-off point. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. As I say, this project forms one of a suite of 18 projects that I look after, and all 18 projects are under the same rules from that perspective in that the money must be spent by December 2019. We're on track to do that, even with the delays that we've had with the Weymouth project. We are comfortably within that scheme. So whilst that deadline is very much there and something we're mindful of, we are within where we would expect to be to meet that.
Now, I mean, from what you're saying, it would appear that it's going to take many months. So will Weymouth get its lighting this year?
Yes.
And will it get it this summer?
That depends on a number of factors which I can't really disclose.
That sounds like a bit of a no to me.
Well, like I say, there are things ongoing behind the scenes which are commercially sensitive that obviously you'll understand I'm not able to discuss on radio.
Right. And it has been indicated to me that there could be a budget shortfall for the job, for the work.
I'm not in a position to comment on budgets and figures at this stage.
All right. Well, look, I can tell that we're going to be talking about this again sometime, but thank you very much indeed for being frank and for answering some, I apologise, rather tricky questions.
Yes, indeed. Some tricky questions there, John.
Oh, I love tricky questions, don't you? I sometimes think I'm not gutsy enough. But, you know, we have to remember this is community radio, not Today programme with John Humphreys.
Absolutely, indeed. Now then, John, we've just got a few seconds left, right at the end of the programme now, to look ahead to, I think, a special programme we'll be doing in a few weeks' time. What are you working on?
I'm working on a D-Day special. I'm looking for people, and it's going to be called D-Day Voices. So I'm looking for people who have any sort of remembrance about D-Day, things that happened around D-Day, and would you believe it, I have found people who are going to contribute to that programme.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm very much looking forward to that. That's going to be on, hopefully, the 5th of June.
That's right.
The day before the actual 75th anniversary.
Correct.
Indeed. Well, there we are, folks. That's where we bring to an end this edition of Ridgeway Magazine. We really hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll tune in next time on Wednesday at 11. In the meantime, from John and me, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.